Chapter 2. The Divine Teacher. The peculiarity of the Gita, among the great religious books of the world, is that it does not stand apart as a work by itself. The fruit of the spiritual life of a creative personality, like Christ, Muhammad, or Buddha, or of an epoch of pure spiritual searching, like the Veda and Upanishads, but is given as an episode in an epic history of nations and their wars, and men and their deeds, and arises out of a critical moment in the soul of one of its leading personages, face to face with the crowning action of his life, a work terrible, violent, and sanguinary, at the point when he must either recoil from it altogether or carry it through to its inexorable completion. It matters little whether or no, as modern criticism supposes, the Gita is a later composition inserted into the mass of the Mahabharata by its author in order to invest its teaching with the authority and popularity of the great national epic. There seem to me to be strong grounds against this supposition for which, besides the evidence, extrinsic or internal, is in the last degree scanty and insufficient. But even if it be sound, there remains the fact that the author has not only taken pains to interweave his work inextricably into the vast web of the larger poem, but is careful again and again to remind us of the situation from which the teaching has arisen. He returns to it prominently, not only at the end, but in the middle of his profoundest philosophical disquisitions. We must accept the insistence of the author and give its full importance to this recurrent preoccupation of the teacher and the disciple. The teaching of the Gita must, therefore, be regarded not merely in the light of a general spiritual philosophy or ethical doctrine, but as bearing upon a practical crisis in the application of ethics and spirituality to human life. For what that crisis stands, what is the significance of the battle of Kurukshetra and its effect on Arjuna's inner being? We have first to determine if we would grasp the central drift of the ideas of the Gita. Very obviously, a great body of the profoundest teaching cannot be built round an ordinary occurrence which has no gulfs of deep suggestion and hazardous difficulty behind its superficial and outward aspects, and can be governed well enough by the ordinary everyday standards of thought and action. There are, indeed, three things in the Gita which are spiritually significant, almost symbolic, typical of the profoundest relations and problems of the spiritual life and of human existence at its roots. They are the divine personality of the teacher, his characteristic relations with his disciple, and the occasion of his teaching. The teacher is God himself descended into humanity. The disciple is the first, as we might say in modern language, the representative man of his age, closest friend, and chosen instrument of the avatar. His protagonist in an immense work and struggle, the secret purpose of which is unknown to the actors in it, known only to the incarnate Godhead, who guides it all from behind the veil of his unfathomable mind of knowledge. The occasion is the violent crisis of that work and struggle at the moment when the anguish and moral difficulty and blind violence of its apparent movements forces itself with the shock of a visible revelation on the mind of its representative man, and raises the whole question of the meaning of God in the world, and the goal and drift and sense of human life and conduct. India has from ancient times held strongly a belief in the reality of the avatara, the descent into form, the revelation of the Godhead in humanity. In the West, this belief has never really stamped itself upon the mind because it has been presented through exoteric Christianity as a theological dogma without any roots in the reason and general consciousness and attitude towards life. But in India, it has grown up and persisted as a logical outcome of the Vedantic view of life and taken firm root in the consciousness of the race. All existence is a manifestation of God because He is the only existence, and nothing can be accepted as either a real figuring or else a figment of that one reality. Therefore, every conscious being is in part or in some way a descent of the infinite into the apparent finiteness of name and form. But it is a veiled manifestation, and there is a gradation between the supreme being of the divine and the consciousness shrouded partly or wholly by ignorance of self in the finite. The conscious embodied soul is the spark of the divine fire, and that soul in man opens out to self-knowledge as it develops out of ignorance of self into self-being. The divine also, pouring itself into the forms of the cosmic existence, is revealed ordinarily in an efflorescence of its powers, in energies and magnitudes of its knowledge, love, joy, developed force of being, in degrees and phases of its divinity. But when the divine consciousness and power, taking upon itself the human form and the human mode of action, possesses it not only by powers and magnitudes, by degrees and outward faces of itself, but out of its eternal self-knowledge, when the unborn knows itself and acts in the frame of the mental being and the appearance of birth, that is the height of the conditioned manifestation. It is the full and conscious descent of the Godhead. It is the avatara. The Vaishnava form of Vedantism, which has laid most stress upon this conception, expresses the relation of God in man to man in God by the double figure of Nara Narayana, associated historically with the origin of a religious school very similar in its doctrines to the teaching of the Gita. Nara is the human soul which, eternal companion of the divine, finds itself only when it awakens to that companionship and begins, as the Gita would say, to live in God. Narayana is the divine soul always present in our humanity, the secret guide, friend, and helper of the human being, the Lord who abides within the heart of creatures of the Gita. When within us, the veil of that secret sanctuary is withdrawn, and man speaks face to face with God, hears the divine voice, receives the divine light, acts in the divine power, then becomes possible the supreme uplifting of the embodied human conscious being into the unborn and eternal. he becomes capable of that dwelling in God and giving up of his whole consciousness into the divine, which the Gita upholds as the best or highest secret of things, uttamam rahasyam. When this eternal divine consciousness, always present in every human being, this God in man, takes possession partly or wholly of the human consciousness and becomes invisible human shape, the guide, teacher, leader of the world, not as those who living in their humanity yet feel something of the power or light or love of the divine gnosis informing and conducting them, but out of that divine gnosis itself, direct from its central force and plenitude. Then we have the manifest avatar. The inner divinity is the eternal avatar in man. The human manifestation is its sign and development in the external world. When we thus understand the conception of the avatarhood, we see that whether for the fundamental teaching of the Gita, our present subject, or for spiritual life generally, the external aspect has only a secondary importance. Such controversies as the one that has raged in Europe over the historicity of Christ would seem to a spiritually minded Indian largely a waste of time. He would concede to it a considerable historical but hardly any religious importance. For what does it matter in the end whether a Jesus, son of the carpenter Joseph, was actually born in Nazareth or Bethlehem, lived and taught and was done to death on a real or trumped-up charge of sedition, so long as we can know by spiritual experience the inner Christ, live uplifted in the light of his teaching, and escape from the yoke of the natural law by that atonement of man with God of which the crucifixion is the symbol. If the Christ, God made man, lives within our spiritual being, it would seem to matter little whether or not a son of Mary physically lived and suffered and died in Judea. So too, the Krishna, who matters to us, is the eternal incarnation of the divine, and not the historical teacher and leader of men. In seeking the kernel of the thought of the Gita, we need, therefore, only concern ourselves with the spiritual significance of the human divine Krishna of the Mahabharata, who is presented to us as the teacher of Arjuna on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. The historical Krishna no doubt existed. We meet the name first in the Chanda Yoga Upanishad, where all we can gather about him is that he was well known in spiritual tradition as a knower of the Brahman, so well known indeed in his personality and the circumstances of his life that it was sufficient to refer to him by the name of his mother as Krishna, son of Devaki, for all to understand who was meant. In the same Upanishad, we find mention of King Dhritarashtra, son of Vichitravirya, and since tradition associated the two together so closely that they are both of them leading personages in the action of the Mahabharata, we may fairly conclude that they were actually contemporaries and that the epic is to a great extent dealing with historical characters and in the war of Kurukshetra with a historical occurrence imprinted firmly on the memory of the race. We know too that Krishna and Arjuna were the object of religious worship in the pre-Christian centuries. And there is some reason to suppose that They were so in connection with the religious and philosophical tradition from which the Gita may have gathered many of its elements, and even the foundation of its synthesis of knowledge, devotion, and works, and perhaps also that the human Krishna was the founder, restorer, or at the least, one of the early teachers of this school. The Gita may well, in spite of its later form, represent the outcome in Indian thought of the teaching of Krishna, and the connection of that teaching with the historical Krishna, with Arjuna, and with the war of Kurukshetra may be something more than a dramatic fiction. In the Mahabharata, Krishna is represented both as the historical character and the avatar. His worship and avatarhood must therefore have been well established by the time. Apparently, from the 5th to the 1st centuries BC, when the old story and poem or epic tradition of the Bharatas took its present form. There is a hint also in the poem of the story or legend of the avatars' early life in Vrindavan, which, as developed by the Puranas into an intense and powerful spiritual symbol, has exercised so profound an influence on the religious mind of India. We have also in the Harivansha an account of the life of Krishna, very evidently full of legends, which perhaps formed the basis of the Puranic accounts. But all this, though of considerable historical importance, has none whatever for our present purpose. We are concerned only with the figure of the divine teacher as it is presented to us in the Gita, and with the power for which it there stands in the spiritual illumination of the human being. The Gita accepts the human avatarhood, for the Lord speaks of the repeated, the constant manifestation of the divine in humanity, when He, the eternal, unborn, assumes by His Maya, by the power of the infinite consciousness to clothe itself apparently in finite forms, the conditions of becoming which we call birth. But it is not this upon which stress is laid, but on the transcendent, the cosmic, and the internal divine. It is on the source of all things, and the master of all, and on the Godhead secret in man. It is this internal divinity who is meant when the Gita speaks of the doer of violent asuric austerities troubling the God within, or of the sin of those who despise the divine lodged in the human body, or of the same Godhead destroying our ignorance by the blazing lamp of knowledge. It is then the eternal avatar, this God in man, the divine consciousness, always present in the human being, who manifested in a visible form, speaks to the human soul in the Gita, illumines the meaning of life and the secret of divine action, and gives it the light of the divine knowledge and guidance, and the assuring and fortifying word of the Master of Existence in the hour when it comes face to face with the painful mystery of the world. This is what the Indian religious consciousness seeks to make near to itself in whatever form, whether in the symbolic human image it enshrines in its temples, or in the worship of its avatars, or in the devotion to the human guru through whom the voice of the one world teacher makes itself heard. Through these, it strives to awaken to that inner voice, unveil that form of the formless, and stand face to face with that manifest divine power, love, and knowledge. Secondly, there is the typical, almost the symbolic significance of the human Krishna who stands behind the great action of the Mahabharata, not as its hero, but as its secret center and hidden guide. That action is the action of a whole world of men and nations, some of whom have come as helpers of an effort, and result by which they do not personally profit. And to these, he is a leader, some as its opponents, and to them he also is an opponent, the baffler of their designs and their slayer, and he seems even to some of them an instigator of all evil and destroyer of their old order and familiar world and secure conventions of virtue and good. Some are representatives of that which has to be fulfilled, and to them he is counselor, helper, friend. Where the action pursues its natural course, or the doers of the work have to suffer at the hands of its enemies and undergo the ordeals which prepare them for mastery, the avatar is unseen or appears only for occasional comfort and aid. But at every crisis his hand is felt, yet in such a way that all imagine themselves to be the protagonists, and even Arjuna, his nearest friend and chief instrument, does not perceive that he is an instrument and has to confess at last that all the while he did not really know his divine friend. He has received counsel from his wisdom, help from his power, has loved and been loved, has even adored without understanding his divine nature. But he has been guided like all others through his own egoism, and the counsel, help, and direction have been given in the language and received by the thoughts of the ignorance. Until the moment when all has been pushed to the terrible issue of this struggle on the field of Kurukshetra, and the avatar stands at last, still not as fighter, but as the charioteer in the battle car which carries the destiny of the fight. He has not revealed himself even to those whom he has chosen. Thus, the figure of Krishna becomes, as it were, the symbol of the divine dealings with humanity. Through our egoism and ignorance, we are moved, thinking that we are the doers of the work, vaunting ourselves as the real causes of the result, and that which moves us we see only occasionally as some vague or even some human and earthly fountain of knowledge, aspiration, force, some principle or light or power which we acknowledge and adore without knowing what it is until the occasion arises that forces us to stand arrested before the veil. And the action in which this divine figure moves is the whole wide action of man in life, not merely the inner life, but all this obscure course of the world, which we can judge only by the twilight of human reason as it opens up dimly before our uncertain advance the little span in front. This is the distinguishing feature of the Gita, that it is the culmination of such an action which gives rise to its teaching, and assigns that prominence and bold relief to the gospel of works which it enunciates with an emphasis and force we do not find in other Indian scriptures. Not only in the Gita, but in other passages of Mahabharata, we meet with Krishna declaring emphatically the necessity of action. But it is here that he reveals its secret and the divinity behind our works. The symbolic companionship of Arjuna and Krishna, the human and the divine soul, is expressed elsewhere in Indian thought. in the heavenward journey of Indra and Kutsa, seated in one chariot. In the figure of the two birds upon one tree in the Upanishad. In the twin figures of Nara and Narayana, the seers who do tapasya together for the knowledge. But in all three, it is the idea of the divine knowledge in which, as the Gita says, all action culminates that is in view. Here it is instead the action which leads to that knowledge, and in which the divine knower figures himself. Arjuna and Krishna, this human and this divine, stand together not as seers in the peaceful hermitage of meditation, but as fighter and holder of the reins in the clamorous field, in the midst of the hurtling shafts, in the chariot of battle. The teacher of the Gita is therefore not only the God in man who unveils himself in the word of knowledge, but the God in man who moves our whole world of action, by and for whom all our humanity exists and struggles and labors, towards whom all human life travels and progresses. He is the secret master of works and sacrifice, and the friend of the human peoples.